ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Heyo, how you doing? We in a New Yorker mood today, and we's gonna have a good time.
Wow, send this guy to New York for a few days, and this is what comes back.
No, I'm actually just been inspired.
What's up with you, Vinny?
How you doing? Hey,
how you doing, man?
How you be doing? How you be doing? Hey, we got a show for you today with the Filmlosophers. You know,
Okay, 3 days in New York is not enough to get you to master the dialect.
But we do have an awesome show in store for you guys. We are fresh from the theater of watching an incredible film. And we're going to do a little bit of a review for you today. So, of course, my name is Eddie.
I'm Chad.
And we are the Filmlosophers.
Howdy.
The show is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each and every week at VGB Studios in Sacramento, California. Remember, Filmlosopher fans, you can subscribe to the Filmlosophers podcast on your favorite platforms and download previous episodes from Stitcher, Player FM, iTunes, Google Play, Audio Boom, or Libsyn. I'm still getting used to saying Filmlosopher fans. That's just...
It doesn't roll off the tongue. It kind of... off the tongue.
But it is a work in progress, ladies and gentlemen. It is something that we are still developing.
And no one else can claim it.
Exactly. We're also Filmlosophizing on social media. You can like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Share your thoughts about recent movie news and let us know what you think about our latest episodes. And of course, you can always find us on vgbstudios.com, the website that has not only our podcast, but Video Game Bang and Me, Mike, Self, and I.
It's like the crown jewel of the VGB Studios. Crown the website.
Oh, true.
I mean,
that.
It's the hub of all activity.
It is.
All communication, all insight and wonderment.
That's right.
Okay.
Not to mention, you can catch all their latest blogs. Like I said, folks, we got a great show in store for you. But of course, before we get to anything else, we always got to hit the movie news. So, at the top of our list, we got. You know, let me just say, I'm actually excited about today's show because the film we saw was really unique, and it's probably one of the first of this year that we've got a chance to review like it. So,
We've just kind of we're transitioning out of summer blockbuster season and all of the flops and successes and whatever that entails, and now we're headed into awards central.
The Oscar race has begun.
The race is on.
So into movie news, we just want to let you give you a little bit of an update. The Filmlosophers actually attended SAC Anime and got a chance to speak to comedic voice actor John DiMaggio. So this past weekend, our home city of Sacramento held its biannual event, SAC Anime, which occurs during the fall and winter of our fair city. Filmlosopher Eddie, which is me, got a chance to attend the event as we sponsored our fellow VGB Studios podcast, Video Game Bang, at their panel with prizes and giveaways. The event went off without a hitch, awarding the person with the best movie question with a special 2016 San Diego Comic-Con exclusive Harry Potter pin set. We also got a chance to speak to the incredibly talented voice actor John DiMaggio and get his take on his role in the upcoming Transformers film, roles he'd love to jump into, and even some words of advice for anyone thinking about becoming a voice actor. We'll debut that interview actually later this week.
And for anybody who doesn't know, John DiMaggio is basically like the king of voice acting in the modern day.
Yeah, he's very well known in both the children sector as well as the adult because of his roles as Jake the Dog in Adventure Time and his roles as Bender in Futurama. Of course, he's had several other roles that he's done, and they're probably good too, but the most notable that I know of...
No, they are good.
I'm pretty sure they are fantastic, but I...
Again, he's the king.
From this table here, including the fly on the wall, Corey is a huge fan of Adventure Time, and I'm a huge fan of Futurama. And so getting a chance to talk to the guy who voiced...
And I don't watch cartoons generally, but I do know his name. Like, I know him by name, even though I don't... watch that type of entertainment programming.
Yeah, and mind you, he's not so much as just some random voice actor, but as Chad said, he is a very well-known, he's one of the more notable voice actors in the business right now, as not only does he do his voice acting work, but he also speaks on behalf of other voice actors. He's a voice for that community, as put by the documentary that came out not too long ago, I Know That Voice.
Yeah, last year or the year before?
I want to say it was the year before.
Yeah, but I mean, it's essentially, I mean, it's about a bunch of people, but he's kind of the steady hand through the whole documentary.
Yeah. So we will debut that article later this week. And, you know, it was an awesome opportunity to be able to see Video Game Bang hold their panel. Corey did a tremendous job. And like I said,
As always.
And we did award a special exclusive San Diego Comic-Con item to the best movie question, which was, how do you differentiate between movies you want to see and not want to see when everybody's telling you that you should see their movie? How do you choose? How do you whittle down? And we all gave great answers. The question was cross-platformed as far as between games and movies, but I think everybody gave an exquisite answer, and she was very, very knowledgeable in asking the right question. So kudos to you.
Way to put your thinking cap on.
Right. Moving forward, we got some new set photos and videos that reveal not only Artemis, but also set pieces in Spielberg's sci-fi adaptation of Ready Player One.
This is a book that you love.
I am in love with this book. I read it when it came out. And then online, I read it online, and then I got a copy in, I believe it was Loot Crate. They actually sent a box.
Honestly, I remember the day that you opened that box, because it was like a spotlight shown down from heaven.
'Tis true.
And you lifted up that book like it was baby Simba.
Oh, yeah.
In The Lion King, and it was a whole moment. Yeah.
It was cool. And
what's
reading
the guy's name? Ernest Cline, right? Ernest Cline. Is the author? Yeah.
Yes. And his book is one of a kind. It's in this day and age, most books like this, they're usually in trilogies. They're usually in series. I mean, and not to say that's a bad thing. I mean, we here on the Filmosophers had an opportunity to speak to Pierce Brown about his trilogy, which was an exquisite work. It's just awesome.
Yeah, Red Rising trilogy. If you haven't read it, go do it right now.
But this book, it's just one book, and I don't believe Ernest Cline is planning on making continuations off of that, but the book itself is just phenomenal. It's an outstanding book about a dystopic future where everybody is, it's like the stripped down reality based version of the Matrix. Ultimately, someone had put it, it's like the Matrix meets Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. So
I can't say that sells me on it, but your enthusiasm sells me on it.
Yeah, I'm excited. You know, a bevy of new Ready Player One set photos and videos from the London-based production have landed online that are sure to make fans of the book positively giddy with anticipation, which it has, me included. This isn't just any old adaptation, as none other than Steven Spielberg handpicked Ernest Cline's 80s-infused sci-fi story for his next project. The film tackles some heavy subjects like VR and over-reliance on technology, but it's all wrapped up in an entertaining yarn filled to the brim with references to iconic 80s films, music, and video games, which kind of lends to the idea why I like the book so much.
It's like your whole childhood presented again in a new form.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. As odd as it sounds, I would personally have loved to have been in this book, just to be in the time era of how things are. Yes, it's a dystopic future and whatnot, but the fact that...
Aren't they all anymore?
Right, seriously. But the fact that everything is based off of your knowledge of 80s just trivia is like, that's gold to me. I could win stuff in that. I could be somebody. No, I'm just kidding.
Eddie, you're somebody now. You're somebody to me and to our faithful listeners.
I appreciate it. The film takes place in a dystopian future, the year 2044 to be exact, in which society spends ever more time immersed into a virtual reality world called the Oasis. Think of it like the internet, but for VR. Oasis is where students attend public schools. It's where folks play a variety of games and even a massive marketplace where goods are bought and sold. Ultimately, the film and the book are about a boy, or pretty much this nationwide manhunt for this game developer who passed his fortune that he left to whomever finds it within the game. And So this is that's the whole.
So you follow the clues, you solve the puzzles, you get the fortune.
Oh yeah. So it's a great book.
Sounds like it'll make a good movie.
Oh yeah. If you haven't read it, get a chance to read it. It's only one book. It's not a series of books, and I'm excited to see what Steven Spielberg will do. We talked a little bit at the film today, and I was telling you if Steven Spielberg did what he did with AI as far as his attention to detail and his attention to the visual aesthetics, not so much as the prolonged story of the 2.5 hour long AI, but more along the lines of really giving audiences that feel of immersion within the film by adding every single bit of detail to it and whatnot, I think I would be a happy guy. I definitely would be happy.
Well, I think you probably will. I mean, Spielberg is definitely a bit of a futurist, among other things. I mean, he has both AI and Minority Report came out not too far from each other, and both of them had a lot of detail invested in, you know, their version of the future, their vision of the future. So this is kind of right up his alley already. And since all the references are from the 80s, which were most of his heyday, not that he hasn't done great things since then, because he has, but that's what really, really established him as one of the elite directors in Hollywood. So, I mean, it's got to be both familiar and preferred and exciting.
Yeah.
Those are three things. So both all of those three things.
And what's incredible about this is that the character in the book has this huge fascination with Steven Spielberg 80s films. So to have that kind of flip around and actually have...
So kind of similar to the way that Chris Pratt predicted years ago that he would be in a Jurassic Park 4 and then ultimately ended up starring in Jurassic World.
Yes.
This is another way that somebody weaseled their way in through Inception into Steven Spielberg's, you know, universe.
Hey, you know what? I mean, whatever works, right? And you got the guy who can make it happen with his awesome creativity.
I think it's a great tactic.
It really is. I mean, you
we should write a book and invite our favorite director to be in the book so that they can immediately produce the movie.
M. Night Shyamalan?
We'll have to talk offline about which director we're going to choose and which ones, like M. Night, are off limits.
Yeah, well, moving
forward.
We
don't want it to be dead right out of the chute.
No joke. This isn't going to be The Village Part 2. Moving forward, James Gunn answers 20 of the most asked questions about Guardians of the Galaxy 2 and other things. James Gunn has been one of the most vocal directors in the Marvel Universe. In a recent Facebook post from the man himself, he did something that most directors would never conceive of doing. He answered questions. That's right, for all Facebook to see, James Gunn answered 20 of the most asked questions in his Gunn way and posted them right away for social media to decipher whichever way they want. Questions range from his favorite Marvel film outside of Guardians of the Galaxy to whether or not Thanos is in Volume 2.
And can I just say, I mean, some people hear this and they're like, well, I mean, this, the director's just answering some questions. He's not going to give away any monumental details because there hasn't even been a trailer yet. And that's true, but James Gunn is such a personality, and I think that many of the elements that people love about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1 are actually James Gunn expressing himself. I mean, it's so much, you've got these colorful characters, intergalactic and whatever. One of them's a tree, one of them's a raccoon, and there are a couple blue ones and a green one and another, you know, greenish gray and whatever. But so many of the qualities that you're really loving, that's his investment in the story shining through in many ways, from the soundtrack to the costumes to the just the overall spirit of fun amidst all the hijinks of, you know, dramatic, intergalactic, manhunt kind of stuff that's going on and saving societies and everything. And so actually for a Q&A, it's really entertaining to read. And there are more than 20 questions in there because, as he points out throughout, some people are just telling him things and not asking him questions.
And the unique thing about James Gunn, he did something that no Marvel director had been able to do. He came in and created a film that not only translates to fans of the franchise as well as children, but he was able to step out of that and reach beyond that and go to, you know, other demographics, those people who love the classic songs that he used, the people who love people that are into wrestling, people. I mean, he really stretched out. If you really think about the genius that is James Gunn, he really allowed what he did to go beyond what every other Marvel film had done. He'd broken the mold, ultimately, and really created something that was a first for Marvel in my book.
Yeah, well, it was basically a perfect storm because they didn't know if it would work. It was an exploration, and it paid off big time, you know, but they kind of, the beautiful thing about it is because they knew that they needed to experiment and not necessarily tie all of these characters in this part of the universe immediately to Captain America, Iron Man, Thor, Black Widow, all of them, they knew going in that, well, it might not be as popular as the other ones, so we're going to let it kind of hang out over here off to the side of this space map, let's say. And because of that, and because of its success, now James Gunn has his own like pocket over there that he can basically do anything he wants as long as it doesn't contradict kind of the master architecture of the MCU.
Like bringing Howard the Duck to an end credit scene that has no impact on the entire franchise as a whole. Something like that. I mean, that's something that's unique. That's something that's notable. That's something that only a director of, you know, somebody like James Gunn can do.
Yeah.
So, but of course, we will post the link to our Facebook page and let everybody see all the wacky ways and everything that James Gunn did. But that does bring us to our main segment of tonight, and that is the review of Sully. Ladies and gentlemen, the film doesn't come out till this Friday, but we got a chance to see it tonight, and tell you what, Clint Eastwood can fly. Just that's all I can say. This man has done hit after hit after hit, and yes, there's a lot of people who will have mixed thoughts and whatever, but you know what? This was a very enjoyable experience, and it was a very awesome opportunity that we got, and we're gonna have some fun talking about it.
Yeah, it's interesting because you know, it's a story that, I mean, it's based in real life.
Yes.
The pilot who historically landed a plane successfully in the Hudson River a few years ago, in the New York metro area, and everyone on board survived.
Yep.
The event, and so it definitely in real life it could have gone a different way, but even as a movie, like, you know the outcome of it, and you know kind of the general gist of the story, so I mean it definitely could have been less interesting than it ultimately turned out to be. They did some interesting things with the way they structured the story, to make it compelling and not just chronological format necessarily, in ways that really paid off.
That's right, we're talking about Sully, the film directed by Clint Eastwood. It stars Tom Hanks, Aaron Eckhart, Valerie Mahaffey, and many others. Quick flash
Laura
synopsis.
Linney.
Laura Linney. Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
She was in it. Flash synopsis says the story of Chelsea Sullenberger, who became a hero after gliding his plane along the water in the Hudson River, saving all of the airplane flight's 155 crew and passengers. That sounded a little jumbled. So
January 15th, 2009.
Yeah.
This was the U.S. Airways flight that had both engines knocked out by a crazy giant flock of birds.
Mm-hmm.
So birds flew in and damaged both engines right after takeoff, and then he could not get back to LaGuardia Airport, which is the largest airport in the New York metro area.
Mm.
So he couldn't get there. He couldn't get to a couple of alternate airports in New Jersey, and he and his co-pilot had to safely land the plane on the water.
Yeah. And the film is based off of the autobiography called Highest Duty, which was co-written by Chesley Sullenberger and Jeffrey Zaslow. Overall, what would you say your impression of the film as a whole would be?
I think that I feel like I sound like Howie Mandel on America's Got Talent. I would say inspiring is a word that easily came to mind. Even early on in the film, I think especially upon leaving the theater, because one of the final notes of the film, and this doesn't really spoil anything, but one of the final notes of the film is Sully, this Captain Sullenberger, played by Tom Hanks in the movie. One of the last things that you hear in the film is Sully has been congratulated for being a hero, that he is the reason why all of these people survived, and things, every other scenario would have ended much worse.
Mm-hmm.
And And then he responds, and this is taken from actual testimony given during his, you know, the investigation into the crash and everything. And he says, you know, it wasn't just me. It was my co-pilot. It was the other crew members in the cabin. It was all of the passengers. It was the New York ferry boat people that came and saved people. It was the NYPD and the Red Cross and whomever. And really, I think that that's one of the things that is so amazing about the real life story, mm-hmm. And such a mark of the integrity of the actual Captain Sully, that it's, you know, it's not I'm a superhero. Like, there's a humility that's really appealing, and I think that throughout the film, that's what was so inspiring to me about it, was that they really display the humanity of Captain Sully and his humility in facing not only the challenge of that day with the engines going out and the landing on the water and everything, but all of the challenges that came up for him in his personal life and his professional life during this inquiry into, you know, what happened and could it have gone differently.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, my overall impression of the film, I thought it was good. I thought it was it wasn't one of Clint Eastwood's best films, but it was definitely up there as one of his better films. It was a good film from Clint Eastwood. There are a couple things that we'll talk about here and there, and as we go through the film. But that's my general impression, just basically right off the cuff. As we dive in, first you begin the film with a really interesting scene. So obviously the incident has been reported all over the news. You've seen it, as Chad mentioned, it was in the previous history. You know, if you were alive to see it, you know, I don't know if you were born in the last 6-7 years, but you may remember the incident that happened in New York, where the plane does go down in the Hudson River, and he was able to safely pilot it into the river without any casualties. So the film opens with a very interesting scene where we see Captain Sully, as well as his co-pilot, who's played by Aaron Eckhart, and they're trying to pilot this plane that's going down, and suddenly the plane, you know, takes a nosedive into one of the local buildings, and you're like, wait, that's not how I remember it. Hold on. And of course, it's obviously a dream. It's you know, and the film starts out by establishing that the events had already happened, which I thought was very unique. It didn't start out with the inciting incident. It didn't start out with, well, we're going to build up to the incident when it happens, and then we'll kind of steamroll down that hill once we get there. The incident was not the climactic point, so to speak, of the issue. It was an incident that already happened, and this is kind of the fallout of it. Now, it does revisit it throughout the film, of course, but I thought that was a very unique approach that Clint Eastwood took when it came to beginning his story. He started the story already after the major incident had already occurred and begun with the inquisition, if you will, of the two pilots.
Sure. One of the interesting things that the story does, like you said, right at the beginning, it puts you into a dream sequence that you don't immediately know is a dream sequence. Mm-hmm. And so you're watching things like, you know, the plane banks left across actually like that the island of Manhattan through the mm-hmm. skyscrapers and everything, and you're sitting there thinking, I mean, if you have any awareness at all of what happened, or if you've seen the trailer for the movie and you know that the plane ends up in the river, you know that it has no business curving into the buildings, yeah. and trying to get over the buildings and failing. So your brain is fighting right off the bat with, okay, wait, what is the reality that I'm being shown? Because this is not what happened. And then, of course, you know, Captain Sullivan, played by Tom Hanks, he jolts awake in the middle of the night. He's having a nightmare of what could have happened had he made different choices.
Yeah.
And what I thought was brilliant about that choice, from a structural point of view, that's probably the way the script is written. That's certainly the way the movie was edited together, was to, like you said, start you after the events have already occurred, but before there's an actual resolution to the situation. Because the movie is really more about the Inquisition, as you said,
yeah.
The investigation into the crash, which happens after any incident, right? I mean, the Department of Transportation, the NTS, what is it, NTSB, the FAA, there's a protocol to everything, right? I mean, that's why there are checklists to make sure the plane can take off. Any plane, anytime, can take off in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So then there's a protocol for when things go wrong, and they're following protocol. But marvelously, what Eastwood and his crew is able to do within the film right off the bat is to really plant you into Sully's shoes. I mean, you are anybody who has any bit of anxiety about flying or has never flown because they have anxiety for flying. Anyone who's ever just had weird, nightmarish kind of thoughts, like you're watching this opening sequence and you're gripping the seat,
if the arms of your seat, flying,
you know, like you're like, oh no, this is not how it happened, but it's happening right in front of my face. And oh my gosh, they just crashed into a building and blew up. And then he wakes up. And so that puts you exactly in his shoes, which is brilliant because most of the film is actually told from his point of view. Almost all of the film is told from his point of view.
Yeah.
And this is the easy way to get you. It humanizes him.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of saying, oh, here is the hero. We know he's going to be a hero. Let's just watch him drink coffee and go about his day and visit with the flight attendants before getting on the plane. And everybody thinks everything is hunky-dory, blue skies before, you know, some disaster.
Yeah, and this was another way to really, like Chad said, in Clint Eastwood's efforts to humanize Captain Sully, what it does blatantly and very, very obviously is to establish that this is the inner turmoil that the captain will be facing throughout the whole film. It's kind of like it's like a premonition, so to speak, of his inner battle throughout the entire film. This is his biggest fear. What if? What would have happened? What would have happened? What would have changed if I would have done this? What if anything had been different than what had happened, you know, on that river? And it's the inner struggle that Clint Eastwood very much so makes the audience aware that this is something that we're making visible to you now, but this is something that he will be dealing with throughout this entire film.
Indeed, and just forewarning for anybody who does have some anxiety about flying, you do see variations of the crash sequence repeatedly throughout the film because he has multiple kind of nightmare moments. And then also you essentially see the actual event twice in a way that makes sense. You see it kind of midway through the film and then closer to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also see some flight simulation footage. So there's quite a lot of opportunity for anxiety, let's say.
Yeah. And so as the film progresses after this sequence, you are then introduced to the co-pilot, which is played by Aaron Eckhart. You are then shown the beginning stages of the inquiry that the NTSB is doing as they're trying to find what could have caused this crash. Could there have been any other alternate decisions to be made? Your standard gauntlet of questions for any incident like this. But it is made aware right away that they are looking at some type of human error. And it's made... you're made very well aware that it's a manhunt that they're doing. Pretty much they're trying to figure out, as much as they're playing it up as the professionalism, there is still a sense of they want to find someone to pin this on, and their target at that time is Captain Sully. So you're
purely for his decision making
exactly
ability or lack thereof, because they have sensor data that tells them differently than what he and his co-pilot are reporting.
So we meet the inquiry team. What were your thoughts of seeing Tom Hanks play? Because we've seen him in several roles. We've seen him even play a captain before in Captain Phillips.
Mm-hmm.
What was your take in him playing a role, portraying somebody who is actually real, I guess?
Well, here's the thing.
Aside from playing Walt Disney.
Tom Hanks, for most of his career, Cloud Atlas notwithstanding, for most of his career, has really been an everyman kind of actor.
He has.
That's why he's been so appealing. Even somebody like Forrest Gump, who is a fictional character put into a whole sequence of actual historical events, and then, you know, they change because he's there. Details are different because of him. But he's always had that mass market mainstream appeal. Like, you could bump into this guy on the street and have a conversation with him, and he's not going to be an egomaniac. He's not going to, you know, like, I mean, he's going to take the time to say hello and respect the fact that you're a fan. Like, you just, you get, whether or not he's actually like that in real life, that's the sense that I've always gotten of him.
Yeah.
Based on the roles that he's played. And he has done a number of biopic characters before. He's played Walt Disney.
Walt Disney.
He's Saving definitely charming and engaging on the screen. What I found really interesting about his performance here is that he's not, I wouldn't say he's the Tom Hanks that you're used to.
No.
Because the man that he is embodying in this role is not overly charismatic. Is not depicted in the context of his family and friends. He's very isolated. The only ally that he has consistently through the film is the co-pilot, because the film takes place in the short span of time between the incident where the airplane ended up in the water and when this investigation is concluded. Mm-hmm. So his only family time is on the phone with his wife, played by Laura Linney, intermittently through the film.
Yeah.
Just to kind of show that side of the man. But he never gets to share a room with them.
No.
He's in a hotel room. He's not in a house, you know. And so the scope of the film is very narrow, and therefore, aside from showing some of the anxiety and the bad dreams and everything, but then also on the flip side, the confidence of Captain Sully in saying, I know what I felt in the cockpit. Both of those engines were gone, and we would not have made it to any of the airports that were given as options.
Yeah.
I knew that that was the only choice. It doesn't matter what your computers are showing you. This was the only choice. And I think that he does a great job. It's just not the there's not as much room to act.
Yeah.
Because then it wouldn't be genuine to the man himself.
Well, and that's very true, because Tom Hanks is known for his efforts in dramatic roles as well as comedic roles. I mean, most of the 80s and early 90s were filled with a lot of his comedic opportunities, you know, Sleepless in Seattle, You've Got Mail, all the way back to The Burbs. And
Turner and Hooch, man.
Turner and Hooch. And so you're used to seeing Tom Hanks have a little bit more of an expressive feel to him when you see him on the screen. And in this one, I thought he did play a lot more of a rigid character. His burst of emotions that usually occurred in the comfort of his own time, or in the event when he hears, like, the only time I heard him actually show that emotion was when he did finally hear the life count that was available. The number. But throughout the entire film, you see him play a very rigid and very determined. I would say the better term is determined to, you know, for the case overall. But it suits him very well. It really does, as far as his role as the strong, silent, yet still inner turmoil type. It's a side of Tom Hanks that not many people have had a chance to see on screen, and to see him flesh that out kind of adds another facet to the diamond that is known as Tom Hanks. Aside from Tom Hanks, we also get Aaron Eckhart, who plays his co-pilot in the film, Jeff Skiles. And I just gotta say, that mustache that Aaron Eckhart has was awesome.
It is a monumental mustache.
It's up there with what's the actor from Blue Bloods?
Tom Selleck.
It's
you didn't even need to ask. I knew who you were talking about. Everybody knows who you're talking about.
The man has the stash.
I mean, it's either Tom Selleck or Sam Elliott.
Yeah.
Always.
But Aaron Eckhart really lends his ability to kind of break the tension, whether if it was written for him to do it or it was his contribution to the role. Either way, Aaron Eckhart really allowed the character to be that tension breaker, to be almost that, to be the ballast for the inner turmoil that, you know, Tom Hanks is facing. So having Aaron Eckhart in there, I thought, was a really good addition to the cast.
Yeah, I think it would be really interesting, because obviously the actual real-life Captain Sullivan has gotten a good amount of airtime in media interviews and obviously wrote this book that the movie is based on and
true that.
And does speaking engagements every once in a while now and all that. So there's more familiarity with him. I don't really know that I've ever been curious enough to look up information about the first officer of the flight.
Neither have I, honestly.
You know, because in the film, like you said, Aaron Eckhart, I mean, he brings the balance. He brings the levity to the situations. When Sully still has the weight of his decisions on his shoulders and everybody's questioning him, this, you know, first officer has a little more opportunity to, you know, kind of just shoot the breeze and call people out a little bit, you know, under the table and make remarks that in the context of the scenes of the film feel very comedic, even though usually it's not. He's not being a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
He's just pointing something out in a way that, because the scene is so tense and the questions are so loaded during this investigation, by the time he opens his mouth and says these things, it's a release of tension and so you're laughing. Not necessarily because he's always trying to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be interested to see, you know, is that the way the real guy
yeah.
is? You know, I'm just out of curiosity because it was fun in the movie.
It was, and like I said, it really lends to that comedic break in times of tension throughout the film. So we get a chance to see the opening of the Inquisition and the opening of the interrogation and the investigation. That's the word I'm looking for.
I know. I'm like, you are.
Inquisition, interrogation, inquiry.
They did their job well with you, sir.
That they did.
It does. It feels like an Inquisition.
It does. It does seem like a manhunt.
And it feels, even from the beginning, unnecessary.
It does. It seems like that team, the crew from the NTSB that are conducting the investigation just seem to really be focused in on nailing Captain Sully for, aha, that's what it was, or yep. aha, that's what it was. So you get that throughout the film, and as the inquiries continue and as the investigation pours over, you see Captain Sully continue to dive deeper into this inner turmoil to where at the beginning he was a little bit more steadfast and really sure of himself to where even over the phone as he's talking to his wife, which is played by Laura Linney, which unfortunately we don't get a lot of her, but at the same time she's not as necessary as I thought. You have somebody who's Laura Linney and she's a great actress, but
sure.
her contributions were to really just kind of shift gears for Tom Hanks's character, almost to add to the tension or to increase the tension or to cause a halt to a scene. That's pretty much every time I saw any type of interaction between the two.
Well, it gives you a context. One of the things that I love about Clint Eastwood as a director, whether he's doing a story like this one that's based on real events,
mm-hmm.
Or he's doing something that's a fictional narrative but has a lot of reality to it, like Gran Torino. He's brilliant at showing you human beings.
Yeah.
Not completely heroic, sterling, you know, or platinum, gold, amazing, godlike heroes, and not despicable, despisable, you know, demonic villains. He actually builds a lot of subtext and context in the way that he shows what characters are going through,
mm-hmm.
Or in the scripts he chooses to begin with. I mean, Gran Torino, there you do not pull a lot of punches with that movie. I mean, his character in particular in that movie speaks his mind, and you love him and you hate him.
And with all his colorful language.
Absolutely. You know, this film obviously doesn't have... You want to respect the actual Captain Sullivan, so you mm-hmm. don't have somebody who's both incredibly good and incredibly bad.
Yeah.
But these investigators are asking some very loaded, difficult questions, and it does cause you to question, saying, you know what? I don't remember seeing, like, the reports about transcripts of this investigation.
Yeah.
What if they did find something that was off and we just never knew because he was already held up in the media as a hero?
Yeah.
And there's just no benefit to tearing him down in the public eye. But what if there is something that happened behind closed doors that this movie's going to show us? Ultimately, thankfully, it doesn't come to that point
yeah.
where they have to pin everything on him and you didn't realize that, you know, all this. So... it's nice, but at the same time, again, what I love about Eastwood as a director is that he shows you a whole human being. And the scenes with Laura Linney on the other side of the phone just serves that purpose of saying, hey, they've got maybe some financial issues. Mm-hmm. They've got maybe some marital issues that are just not devastating, but they're not worked out.
Yeah.
And this prolonged separation from each other after what could have been a terrible disaster is not helping their relationship. So all of that, it adds context and subtext to this man, to the, I want to say character, but really to the man himself.
Yeah. And as the film continues on, I mean, there really isn't much to say about the overall story of the film. You have from the opening with the dream sequence all the way throughout the investigation, and you have Captain Sully, you have Captain Skiles, you have them trying to muster the courage to make it each day as the investigation continues to bear down. You see Tom Hanks's character still fighting with that inner turmoil of the what ifs and the, you know, the worst case scenario played out visually at times, happening, you know, as he's looking out a window and he sees a plane land right in the middle of downtown New York, hitting a building, and obviously it's all in his head, but the inner turmoil is there and it's constantly bearing down as the film progresses. The interesting thing about it is that you do get a couple of flashbacks to kind of relay the foundation or to lay the foundation, so to speak, of Captain Sully's character of himself, as you get the image of seeing him as a young man when he first started, you know, learning how to fly, through his time in the military of sorts, the armed forces, whichever. I'm not too sure.
I'm not sure what branch he served in, but yeah. There is one sequence where he's in a fighter jet. There's another fighter jet. The one that he's in has a burnout and might not be able to land. So it's showing you, and mind you, this comes 2/3 of the way through the movie.
It does.
But it's showing you a time when he kept cool under pressure and landed a plane that he might not have been able to land had he not maintained his focus.
Yeah.
Which is something that when he was in the younger scene, which happens earlier in the film, his instructor tells him at one point, always fly the plane.
Yeah.
No matter what the issue is, if it's not performing properly, if there's some kind of a problem going on, always fly the airplane.
Yeah.
You know, and then so it's just these little moments that they thread through there, you know, to your point, to give you what's necessary for you to know about him as a man and as a pilot, but not overdo it. This movie is very lean. It comes in at, what, 91 minutes? 90?
Give or take.
90, 91, 92. I mean, it's a lean movie. It does not waste your time giving you a bunch of extra story elements that are not crucial to understanding, you know, this investigation time frame. It gives you exactly what you need to know. It gives you just a quick dash or two of his personal history as a pilot, kind of how he got his start and where he really earned his wings. So it's a really nice, tight narrative.
It is, and like I said, it's one of those types of narratives that it doesn't seem like there is much progression to the story, because you feel like you're almost at a stalemate with what's going on overall. Mm-hmm. But with the unique addition of the wife in the film, you do get a sense of a subtle victory as the film progresses. So you see that at the beginning of the film, the conversations are a little bit more leaner. They're a little bit more like, okay, well, I gotta go. Oh, wait, I can't hear you. Okay, well, I gotta go. Wait, well, and then click. You get that type of just phone conversation to the storyline progresses, and you see the understanding of the severity of the issue as a whole all the way up until towards the tail end of, or the beginning of the third act, where she calls him in full realization of that, I know that you're about to go into a hearing, but I just wanted to call you and tell you I realized you were one of those 155 that were on the plane. We could have lost you. And you see the victory, even in its smallest amount, kind of, as I said, this film has a sense of a premonition to it as far as you saw what types of things you Captain Sully was going to be dealing with internally, but all the way up until you see her realizing that, you know, oh, we could have lost you, but you didn't. And you see that brief exchange, but there's still a lot of meat in there to understand that, okay, this is okay. This is going to be okay. What about this next event, which takes place in the whole third act, which is the grand, if you will, investigation, the hearing that Captain Sully as well as Captain Skiles, are going to attend to hear the cockpit recordings.
Voice recording, yeah. The interesting thing, one of the items that I really appreciated about this film, and it's really brought home in the climactic sequence, which is listening to the cockpit voice recorder.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I really appreciate about this film is sometimes in movies, because of the type of story it is, say a blockbuster or, you know, just a summer action movie, like you don't really have time in that kind of a movie to show characters waffling back and forth between decisions and like whatever. And one of the things that this movie points out is there is not always perfect clarity at the moment of decision that this is the exact thing that needs to happen. And then separately in retrospect, after a decision has been made, there's not always perfect clarity on, yes, we all agree that that was the right decision and you made it perfectly the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nobody that ever could have made a more perfect decision than you. And one of the things that shows in both the professional and personal sides of Sully's character is, you know, both with his piloting and with his relationship with his wife,
mm-hmm.
there is room to allow oneself to second guess.
Mm-hmm.
To allow oneself to hear input from other people around you and kind of gut check you. Did you make the right call? And that's very human. That happens every day in most of our lives where we have to make decisions and we don't know if we had all the right information going into it. We don't know if we made the right choice. And a year and a half later, when we look back on it, maybe we didn't so all of that, really, in 90 minutes, I mean, you get touches of all of that between he and his wife and with him as a professional, as a pilot,
mm-hmm.
is that room to say, okay, how do I know with confidence that I did make the right decision?
Yeah.
And obviously, 155 people made it off of that plane. There were 155 people on board, 155 people made it off the plane and safely to like hospitals, care facilities, whatever, and lived through that event.
And mind you, just going back a bit, the event that actually occurred, as we mentioned earlier in the review, it is revisited a couple times to recount the incident from different perspectives, whether you're from the perspective of somebody who's in the cabin or you're somebody who is from a barge who is crossing the Hudson River, or from the perspective of the individual who is working the tower, who answered the mm-hmm. distress call from the down plane. And then finally...
Yeah, air traffic control.
The air traffic controller. And then finally you do get the perspective from the cockpit. Those scenes were so well done. Now, mind you, obviously, with CGI and special effects and everything, you can pretty much do just about anything. But short of actually flying a plane into the Hudson for this film, those scenes were pretty incredible. And seeing as they utilized IMAX cameras for those scenes, as well as, you know, utilizing the right amount of budget towards those specific scenes, they didn't need a lot of CGI work throughout the entire film, just mainly for those specific scenes. I'd say Clint Eastwood got his money's worth, hands down.
Oh, for sure, yeah. I mean, they show this thing from multiple angles, multiple times, whether it's the real thing or a like nightmare version of what actually happened. I mean, you see it repeatedly.
Yeah.
And it's believable. I mean, some of the times you know that you're looking at a CGI model, but it doesn't, it does nothing to steal the momentum of the moment.
Yeah. And speaking of momentum, what was one of the most interesting and things, one of the most likable things for me was the music throughout the film, the score that was utilized. It wasn't a very, you know, gaudy type of music. It wasn't like very cinematic, like something from do or something. There wasn't any of that. It was subtle. It was extremely subtle, and it only occurred during tone shifts. It wasn't a very like, oh, we're gonna play this whole violin sequence throughout this entire time so that you know this is a somber moment and blah blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was simple piano keys that were hit during a time when the emotional tone shifted, because you weren't seeing the emotion on Tom Hanks' face, so you needed some type of visual cue to notate, and this is what's going on here. For example, when he was talking to his wife at certain times, and the conversation began to shift to where she began to kind of lose the conversation decorum, I guess you could say, because it would turn into either a slight argument or whatnot, and you can tell that the conversation was going south, because then you just hear ding, ding. It was a very soft and subtle piano that began to play, and you knew as soon as you heard that the emotional shift of the scene was going in a different direction.
Sure.
And it was very well done. It was very well placed. Like I said, it wasn't loud and obnoxious type music. It wasn't, you know, very, you know, in your face, like super Hans Zimmerish. Not that he's obnoxious, but to say that it wasn't in that wheelhouse for
most of his scores are very noticeable.
Yes,
very pronounced. But this one was not. It was very subtle. Also on the sound front, way in the beginning of the movie, the first thing that you do is you hear, while the, you know, production company logos are popping up on the screen and everything, you hear radio traffic and conversation and airplane sounds to kind of get you in the moment early on in that first sequence that turns out to be a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
The sound kind of circles around the theater, like to your left and around behind you, and you kind of feel completely surrounded by these aircraft sounds, and it does a lot to immerse you into it pretty quickly. I thought that the use of sound effects was really well done in this film as well.
The sound editor of this film did pretty much an outstanding job in my book, because of the fact that it wasn't one of those types of things where they were like, all right, we're going to throw in a loud sound of a jet engine here, we're going to throw in a loud sound of that and really jar the audience. No, it were all subtle inputs, and it all built to that very large tension that you were awaiting, because you know the film is based around a plane crash. So there was no hiding that anywhere.
Right.
You knew there was going to be a plane crash. You just didn't know as far as how they were going to set it up.
And you know the outcome of that crash. That's one of the brilliant things with setting the story up as the investigation, is that you didn't have, you know, this dramatic, like, oh, there are problems at home, and what if he's an alcoholic, and what if, you know, what if.
Yeah.
And then it happens, and then, oh, they land safely. Like, there would be something, you'd still feel the triumphant moment of, oh, okay, he got them safely.
Yeah.
Into the water, and then, you know, onto the rafts and everything. But it wouldn't be as fulfilling as this story that they decided to tell, which already knows that you know how the plane incident happened and what the outcome was in general, but you may not know what happened behind closed doors during this investigation. And
and
I found it very compelling that they chose that angle. Also, I know that we're getting ready to wrap this up. I do have to say one of the things that I loved the most, because you recently visited New York.
I
worked in New York for a year after college, back in a former life. One of the things that I loved the most in this film was that New York spirit of the people. The people of New York have a reputation for really like showing up when it counts.
Yeah.
And one of the things that is very true in the real life version of this story is people showed up, like the ferries came over to get passengers off of this plane.
Yeah.
And not into the freezing water of the Hudson. You know, the NYPD sent people, scuba divers and what, like, people did show up in real life, and Clint Eastwood and his team took the time to show it in this movie.
Yeah.
I thought it was tremendously important. I thought it was very poignant because one character points out at some point in the film that at the time, in 2009, people in New York, they needed a good story. And the fact that it was a good story involving a plane in their city was even more powerful. And I think even for those of us who weren't in New York at the time of, you know, 2001, September 11th, or even in New York at the time of 2009 when this incident happened, it's ingrained in our cultural consciousness.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really poignant for them to include a really – it's just a nice touch, and it's not like 2 seconds.
Yeah.
I mean, you see again and again and again people stepping up to the plate.
Yeah, and one last thing to add to that is that I did like how Clint Eastwood did humanize a bit the actual city of New York. It made it almost like the antagonist to the film at the very beginning, and that progression to realizing that New York was not the antagonist, but it was the like you said, it was the all-encompassing hug, so to speak. It was the one that came to the rescue, and I liked how Clint Eastwood made that very apparent throughout the film with the looming buildings that cast shadow over Captain Sully and so forth. So, but in the end, the film does end really well, and of course, we're not going to spoil it for you. We want you to go see it for yourself, but it is an exceptional film. Chad, how many monocles, and does it pass or fail?
It definitely passes. I would say, because I, in my mind, I can't help but compare it to Clint Eastwood's filmography, I would give it a solid 4 out of 5 monocles.
Okay.
Maybe 3.75. No, I'll upgrade. It gave me all the feels.
Okay.
It didn't waste my time. It was 90 minutes long. It was a purposeful 90 minutes, and I really like Tom Hanks, and I really like Clint Eastwood as a director. How about you?
True that. I give it a 3.5 monocles out of 5. It was a good film, but it wasn't one of his best, so, you know, it's a good film, and it does pass for me. But that about wraps up our review for this film. If you believe what we're saying, and if you agree with it, let us know. If you don't agree, let us know as well on Facebook. Before we go, I'm going to leave you a few movie bites. Terrence Malick celebrates life in the cosmos in clips released for Voyage of Time. It's his new IMAX film. Check it out.
Yeah, all IMAX.
Yep.
All Terrence Malick. So take that as you will, because he's a very...
He's a very interesting director.
Unique. He's an auteur.
Yeah.
You know, so he's got a distinctive visual style. He's a poem director.
Whatever that means. Napoleon Dynamite director Jared Hess plans to helm the Shanghai sequel titled Shanghai Dawn. There's going to be another one. We're going to see Owen Wilson and Jackie Chan back at it again. And Lord knows where they're going to go from there.
Jackie Chan, who I just saw recently on social media, so it could be true or not, is the second highest paid actor in the world.
That makes sense. The man
amazing.
Does all his own stunts, and he's done
and
all
I
his
love
own
him.
Stunts since
I mean,
he was
he's amazing.
Yeah. Finally, the first images reveal Denzel Washington and Viola Davis in their major Oscar contender, Fences. Check it out. Look it up on social media. We'll be posting pictures. We'll be posting links. But of course, that wraps up our show for today. Again, we want to thank you for listening. And if you have any thoughts on the show today, if you have any, if you don't agree with us, actually, if you've seen the film and you're like, nope, it was garbage, you guys are wrong, let us know, by all means. Let us know on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Again, we also want to let you know that we are still doing the Transformers giveaway, so all you got to do is like and comment on our page and let us know you want the code for
the
digital download. But of course, you know what? Like we said, it's Oscar season. There's going to be a lot more films that are going to be coming out just like this, and so stay tuned for more reviews as they come. We got a lot of great stuff planned for the rest of this month, so stay close to our Twitter page and our Facebook page, and we'll continue to feed the information to you. So, yeah, That's pretty much all I got to say. I don't know.
I love it. Your momentum was so strong, you didn't realize that you were done.
I was like, I had blown through that
Oscar
so quickly.
Season is a go, and we're excited.
So that about wraps it up again. Yeah, I know I said it earlier, but I'm saying it again. From all of us here at the Film Philosophers, my name's Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.